This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
Most observers agree that drug development clinical trials take too long and cost too much to meet the needs of the world's patients. Many of these observers would also agree that the same digital tools which have transformed information and communication technology can also change drug development and clinical trials for the better. I'm Chris Slowecki, Senior Digital Copy Editor for DIA, and today we're joined by two experts in this field. Lauren Oliva, who serves as Global Regulatory Policy Lead for New Technologies at Biogen, and will also serve as chair for the session titled Drug Development Tools in a Digital Era at our DIA Europe 2020 meeting in Brussels. And Josh Cosman, who serves as Principal Engineer, Digital and Quantitative Medicine for Biogen. Thank you both for joining us today, and welcome. Our first question is for you, Lauren. It's a pretty basic but very important question. In terms of both quality and quantity, how have digital tools improved the collection of data specifically in clinical trials?
In terms of regulatory decision making, the real value that I see is the ability to collect data that improves measurements in interventional studies. So historically, for many rare or progressive diseases, we just haven't had the tools that were sensitive enough to measure the concepts of interest that we were studying well. And this has led to some really long and expensive trials and the need to enroll more subjects to appropriately power those studies, which is a major hurdle in diseases, especially if you have a limited number of patients that you're working with. And it really did create this dilemma of how do we keep an appropriate amount of scientific rigor in the design of our studies while managing the reality that patients are waiting for these products, especially in diseases where there aren't treatments already available. So when I think about what has improved in terms of quality and quantity, I'd say the main driver of improving quality is the patient voice. We've experienced a really long overdue revolution of sorts in the industry where we've realized that patients don't just need to be at the table in the development of drugs, but they need to be driving that conversation. So as we're thinking about digital health technologies, they create the potential to measure things that we couldn't previously measure that are important to patients, like postural instability and movement disorders. In terms of quantity, by collecting data more frequently, you end up with a higher density of data, and that can shed light on previously unmeasured aspects of disease. For instance, when you're assessing cognition, we can now potentially do that on a daily basis with these digital tools at home, as opposed to just during periodic clinic visits. That can give us a better picture of the overall impact of a product on cognitive function. And on the other hand, there is an interesting debate going on right now about is more really better when it comes to data? You can put a wearable in a study and collect terabytes of data, but are you really improving the quality of your decision-making if you don't have a specific hypothesis in mind that you're explicitly testing? And I think the jury is still out on that. It's still definitely a topic of debate. But I do think that there is a value and a place for continuous data collection, and the final answer will probably be somewhere between being so rigorous that no one's willing to invest in this new approach, and so, for a lack of better words, sloppy, that you haven't even taken the time to pre-identify your concept of interest before kind of setting out to do that work. So overall, I'd say the biggest transformation these tools will probably have is improving patient access to trials. The implementation of this still needs to be worked out, and regulators are trying to provide guidance where possible. But the ability for us to reach patients in geographic locations and in demographic groups that the current system is missing is arguably the most important role of these technologies. It has the potential to make the data that we generate in trials more representative and therefore much more generalizable to patients and healthcare providers. So I don't think anyone can argue with the value of that, but the devil will be in the details of how do we get that right.
Well, in addition to being the interviewer today, I'm also a patient. And so thank you for recognizing the importance of pulling us into these conversations and into your answer to that question. Thank you. Josh, may I get you to follow up in response to Lauren's response?
Lauren did a really good job of capturing sort of the promise around digital tools. And with the increased quantity of data, you do increase the quality to some extent in terms of your reach and the types of things that you could measure now that you wouldn't be able to measure in the past, but it leads to this explosion of data. So if you take an example of a standard clinic examination, even though it may not be performed at the highest level of quality, When you get that data back and you're making decisions based on it, you really don't know. You see a number on a page and you don't know anything about how that data was collected. On the flip side of that, in the case of us using sensors, for example, to measure motor impairment, you're getting reams and reams of data. So you're getting maybe terabytes of data over the course of a study. And at some level, the quality takes a hit. In the case of us performing objective measurements, we collect so much data that you do get more information about the patient, but you're much more likely to have missing data, data that you don't understand what was happening or where it came from. And that's something we didn't have to deal with in the past. So I think that the real promise in this is to bring these two together so that we're getting good quality measurements. We understand what data we're collecting in the context in which it's collected in. And then that will ultimately drive better quality for these types of measures going forward. One example that I could point to that is probably not as cool as something like wearable sensors or you know, mobile-based data collection is that we've been using eSource for quite a while, maybe 10 years or more in many of our trials. Like I said, it is not a particularly cool example to mention, but it is something that's exponentially increased the quality of our data collection because we're no longer having to rely on memory and transcribing by the clinician in order to get the data back. We're entering it at the source, and there are things like edit checks in place to make sure that the correct data is being entered at the correct time. So even though it may not be as cool of an example as a wearable device, it's something that has had a major impact on the quality of the data that we obtain in a clinical trial setting because we're able to automate certain procedures that would have otherwise been left open to human error.
Thank you for the specificity in that answer. And I'd like to kind of continue in that theme. Can you provide one or two other examples of digital tool that was implemented to improve either the quality of the clinical trial or the patient experience in the clinical trial?
I think that the eSource example is probably one of the more ubiquitous examples of a success story because it's provided clear success for many trials and will continue to do so as more organizations start to use those tools. On the other end of the spectrum, sort of going back to what we think about in terms of the, I guess, the cooler things like wearable devices that we didn't used to have access to in a clinical trial setting, for those data, I wouldn't say that anybody's gotten it exactly right yet. So at this point, it kind of depends on what you mean by successful. So there have been a lot of learnings from deploying these sorts of tools in clinical trials that have improved their deployment going forward. I would say that nobody's gotten it completely right. It's not like we've registered any drugs on the basis of a digital endpoint. In some cases, we may have used it in decision making, but even there, because this is sort of a nascent field still, and we don't understand how all of these tools operate, I think that the impact of these tools and their deployment and their success is still yet to be realized. I think there are a few components when we think about success, a lot of which would be operational. So it seems deceptively simple to put a wearable device onto somebody and send them out of the clinic and gather tons of data, but making sense of those data is very difficult. So we can get the data back, but what it means is sometimes sort of a black box or it's something that we don't understand well. So to that end, one of the approaches that we've been taking is doing some initial de-risking. So before we launch a new device into a clinical trial, we try to set a series of well-reasoned studies up that start with basic feasibility testing. And this could be either us doing this internally within our organization or working with external collaborators and patients themselves to get information about how best to deploy these tools in an interventional trial setting before we go to the lengths that it would be required for us to actually deploy in an interventional setting. So this could be us collecting small data sets, understanding, you know, where we would expect some of these tools to break or go wrong, getting input from the patients as to whether they're willing to complete the task we're asking them to complete or where the devices we're asking them to wear. And an example of this is a collaboration that we have with Takeda. So Biogen and Takeda have collaborated on a study called WatchPD in Parkinson's disease. So up to this point in Parkinson's disease, probably more than any other disease area, digital tools have been used to quantify aspects of movement or speech or cognition. And what we decided to do in this particular study is take what we know from the last decade and instead of throwing it directly into an interventional trial, decide on what measures we could collect in the most streamlined way with patient input and design a prospective longitudinal study in early Parkinson's disease to understand which of these tools provides the best measurement approaches for measuring different aspects of the disease and which ones would be the most likely to be successful in an interventional trial setting. To date, there have been a number of small studies, typically cross-sectional, and what we really wanted to do is take the most promising measures from those studies and run this longitudinal study with the express goal of developing a core set of tools that we or other companies could deploy in future Parkinson's disease-modifying trials. It's not something that everybody's willing to take on, but it's taking what we know and trying to refine it to the point that we have a greater likelihood of success when it comes time to measure treatment effects, sometimes small treatment effects, in the population of interest.
Lauren, would you have anything to add?
Josh raised some really great examples of the work that's ongoing, and I certainly agree that as an optimist, it's a work in progress, but we're making good progress. I'd also probably highlight one of the approaches taken by the Duchenne's community in the last number of years. The patient advocacy group, Duchenne's UK, has been really proactive, not only in supporting research to include digital tools in Duchenne's trials, but they've actually driven consensus around the approach. So Duchenne's UK, along with one of the developers called SysNav and the Institute of Myology, developed an extensive data set that they then used to gain a EMA qualification opinion on the use of stride velocity as a secondary endpoint in DMD trials. And it also has a pending qualification procedure in the US with the FDA. So they not only tackled the issue at a project-focused level doing that research, but by creating and using these tools, they also saw the need to move the needle on the regulatory acceptance, so they did something about it. These are the examples that are going to determine not only the pace of progress, but also some of the final outcomes and how we'll all get to use these technologies in drug development in the future. So looking at the current landscape and how we anticipate that landscape to change over the coming years, I pretty strongly believe that groups that stand to be most successful are the teams that are taking a dynamic approach like that. They're focusing on the here and now of tackling a tangible project, as Josh mentioned, with WatchPD, something that's actively driving progress and often setting some new precedent on how to execute in the space. But they're also, and I think very importantly, collaborating to address the unresolved issues that are to come. These are the kind of barriers or challenges that no one company or team is going to be able to tackle themselves. Things like developing new data standards to enable data sharing between disparate data sources or engaging in dialogue about expectations in terms of how do we trust this type of data for regulatory decision making. A few groups have made some really excellent contributions to foundational efforts, groups like the Clinical Trial Transformation Initiative. Their mobile clinical trials recommendations have really set a lot of groups that are working in the space up for success. And I'd also commend the FDA's commitment to efforts like the Patient-Focused Drug Development Initiative and some of their ongoing work related to the Digital Health Innovation Plan and the Technology Modernization Action Plan. Those types of projects and initiatives are really huge enablers for the groups working in this space, because it shows people that if they're willing to show up and have the conversation, the agency is open for business, that they see the value of these tools and are willing to have the conversation.
Excellent. Thank you. I'd like to shift the focus of the conversation and focus on clinical data. Are there certain types of data that are better off being collected face-to-face on a personal level in a site visit, and other data are perfectly able to be collected in an efficient, regulatory acceptable way through digital tools? Or is clinical trial data, and it's kind of agnostic to what type of tool was used to collect or measure it? Lauren, could I ask you to start with that one?
That's an excellent question, and it's one of those unknowns that we're trying to figure out through projects like WatchPD. So as Josh was describing before, there are some of these unknowns in the space of, is it better to collect certain types of data with certain types of devices, either at home or in the clinic? And that is one of the questions we're trying to answer. So in the WatchPD study, we're doing that by assessing the same measurements both in clinic and at home, both in healthy volunteers as well as Parkinson's disease patients. And the goal is really to create this baseline of variation seen from collecting data in those two settings. And this is hopefully going to allow us to develop a more informed hypothesis of why we're seeing that variance between those two settings, if we do see variance. And we may determine that some of the differences are simply an artifact of the measurement tool itself or the process that we use in one setting versus another. But the hope, as Josh alluded to before, is that some of the features or signals may show a meaningful difference that can be used as a new signal to measure disease progression in Parkinson's moving forward. So I share that as an example of kind of how we're thinking about it in the space. And the reason that we've decided to take this approach is that we think it will result in the highest quality measures, because they'll be informed by this evidence-based process that we're going through. And it does take some extra planning and investment up front, but we do believe that the payoff will be worth it as we can prioritize collection of the most promising types of data in each particular setting. So if I had to sum up the direction of the field, I'd say that it seems to be converging on two areas of focus in terms of this type of data collection as the low-hanging fruit. The first area is looking at more arguably objective measurements. So this would be things like movement that are normally evaluated by a clinician assessment. So something like gait or stride velocity or balance. There we can use tools both in clinic and at home and compare them to test whether one or the other gives us a better data set. And perhaps if they both serve their own value, depending on sort of the regulatory question at hand, if that's how you're using the data that you're collecting. The second area is on novel data that brings the patient voice into development by measuring impacts that are meaningful to patients, but that we may not have otherwise assessed. And I think this is arguably best done outside of the clinic site, where we can have a patient at home going through the course of their normal day and collecting data more in that naturalistic environment.
There is one thing that was sort of in the background in what Lauren was saying, and one thing that we didn't address already is that with digital tools, for example, a mobile device, we can take tests that we know work well. So you could take the example of a patient-reported outcome that would only typically be collected at a periodic clinic visit. Typically, there's some variation in, for example, mood. So if there were questions about how the patient was feeling on a given day, all you'd know is how they were feeling on the day that they were in the clinic. One thing that mobile tools allow us to do is to take those same PROs, those same questionnaires, asking patients questions about the impact of their disease, and they let them complete them with higher frequency from the comfort of their own home when they want to. And that's important because instead of just getting a snapshot, you get multiple snapshots over prolonged periods of time. And so you're better able to account for that variability and separate that inherent variability that we all have from day to day in our ability to think or move or feel. And you can parcel that out and focus on really what's at hand, the response to treatment or changes in those aspects due to pathology of the disease. So kind of a hybrid is taking things that we currently collect in the clinic, but only periodically, and collecting those same data with higher frequency out of the clinic to get a better gauge of the real reality of the patient and the impact of the disease on the patient. One other thing that I would add in this, and it's going back to this kind of operational component, is that with many of these tools, just like any other sort of digital tool or novel technology, so something like EEG, MRI, ECG, these typically require trained specialists to acquire accurate, reasonable measurements. And the same would be true for most of these novel technologies we're talking about here, wearable devices, mobile devices. So the devil's in the details. And when we're asking our clinical trial sites in the context of interventional trial to implement some of these measures, they're as non-expert as the patients themselves that we may be asking to collect relatively complicated health data on their own through self-administration in a home setting outside of the clinic. Really, a lot of what we focus on is building tools that are easy to use and streamlined in such a way that either a non-expert clinician or a patient themselves would be able to seamlessly collect those data without a bunch of hiccups or problems along the way. So we're kind of trying to error-proof the entire process because many times even the clinics themselves do not have specialists to execute some of the measurements that we ask them to execute in the context of our trials.
It's safe to say that on a summary level, the advent of these digital tools have enabled two things. We are able to more accurately or better measure things that we were able to measure before, but just as, or perhaps even more importantly, we can now measure things that we could not measure before. And you've both kind of intimated in previous answers in the areas of Parkinson's or mood, but I'd like to give you both, Lauren, I'd like to start with you, the chance to discuss in a little more detail, are there specific disease areas or patient groups or therapeutic areas where we're actually beginning to see the promise of collecting data either better or collecting new data that we haven't been able to collect before?
I think the optimist response to this is that it's an active work in progress across a number of therapeutic areas, which is great. It's definitely a focus for sponsors and groups who are interested in these technologies. As a company, Biogen is focused on developing products for neurological diseases. So I can tell you that novel endpoints is a big area of interest for us, and we found no shortage of other companies and partners who are investing in this space as well, which is great to see. So in general, I'd say neurology seems to be one of those therapeutic areas that's pretty ripe for endpoint development as we think about these digital tools. If I had to focus in on one particular area, the one that jumps out to me probably first is the rare disease space. So I mentioned the Duchenne's qualification earlier as an example. I think there's a lot of opportunity in rare diseases, given there may be more regulatory flexibility possible, depending on the level of unmet need within that disease. And as we know, in rare diseases, it can be really hard to enroll the appropriate number of patients into the studies to power the trials appropriately. And we also may not necessarily have established regulatory endpoints, depending on whether or not there's products on the market that have been approved for those diseases. So that often may end up allowing for a bit more of an open dialogue with regulators to take more of a novel approach to improve the quality and the quantity of data, as we talked about before, available for decision making about products. As we've learned about some of these rare diseases, as we've kind of collected more natural history data, diseases like ALS, we've encountered the reality that even within those very small patient populations, there's a lot of heterogeneity between patients. And I think diseases like this seem to be prime candidates for using digital tools to generate some of that higher quality data that may eventually lead to either a new or supplementary endpoint or biomarker. And one example that kind of comes to mind just from this past week is that the FDA had just published a guidance on mucopolysaccharidosis type 3, which is obviously a pretty rare disease. And one of the comments they made on the guidance was instructing sponsors to prioritize efficacy endpoints that assess outcomes that are clinically meaningful to patients and caregivers. They noted that could be used as potentially the basis for a traditional approval. So it wasn't specifically around digital tools, but I think it adds emphasis to the value of having that patient voice as a component of these primary efficacy endpoints. So it's a great space to watch and see progress. And if I can add maybe just one other area that we'd love to see more endpoint development in is chronic and progressive diseases. So we've really struggled with some of the established regulatory endpoints because they may not necessarily capture features that are most important to patients or are simply just not very sensitive to disease change over time. For example, within multiple sclerosis, we know that cognition is an issue that's important to patients and where neurologists are seeking better treatment options. And we get those questions all the time as a company that works in that area. And regulators have publicly recognized that cognition assessment tools are not widely used in MS clinical trials and that the qualification of new tools or instruments or methods would really fulfill an unmet need within that clinical trial realm. So as of now, the available tools, they've drawn mixed support. But this may be an opportunity for digital health technologies in the future.
Josh, I'd like to give you the opportunity to have the last word.
Really, at a high level, in pretty much every disease area, over the last 10 years, we've had many examples where we are definitely able to measure more accurately the things we've been measuring as efficacy endpoints. And in many cases, we're able to measure things that we were never able to measure before. This is kind of what I call the academic piece of all of this. We're still in a learning phase here. And really the important thing to note is that even though we've had a number of discoveries that are promising in pretty much every disease area, just like what's happened in the past with novel tools like EEG or functional imaging, there's going to be a long period of time where we're better understanding the tools, better understanding what these endpoints mean and refining them. That's ultimately going to be a requirement before these types of tools or measures are useful in what is arguably probably the most regulated setting, therapeutic development.
This was just a remarkable conversation. Lauren, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Chris.
And Josh, thank you. For DIA, I am Chris Slowetke.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.